Welcome, Dumbheads, to MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. In this series, we are examining every single goddamn page of Palladium's Beyond the Supernatural RPG to determine what is the dumbest thing on that page. Every episode is one page, every episode is short. If you'd like to play along at home, this is Beyond the Supernatural 2nd Edition, the first printing from January 2005. Today we're discussing page 130 of Beyond the Supernatural. For those who didn't listen to the last episode or may not remember, this is part two of a sort of a dyad of episodes linked together partly by topic, partly by theme, maybe most importantly to you, the listener, by the fact that I have sort of given myself a two-day vacation from making jokes on this ostensibly comedy podcast because I have things to say about these two pages that are like weird little nerdy musings about the way that Beyond the Supernatural presents itself as a role-playing game, especially to new gamers. And you know what? This is my gaming podcast. If I can't air these trivial observations to you here, then where and to whom? I guess I just have to shut the fuck up, and that's not what this hobby is about. So, part two, here we go. We are still in Beyond the Supernatural's introduction to the hobby of role-playing for new gamers. As we talked about yesterday, there's sort of a very basic overview on page 129 about what role-playing is and what you do and don't need to know. I argued then that Beyond the Supernatural is sort of stuck between two different paradigms of gaming. One associated with old-school, predominantly fantasy gaming, where the GM sets challenges and players are expected to use ingenuity and rules mastery and creativity to assail those challenges as best they can. And as they get better at role-playing, quote-unquote, they'll do a better job against those challenges, and they'll get better at the game. I contrasted that with a later model of gaming, championed, although hardly perfected, by the original World of Darkness games, in particular Vampire, where what we're doing is creating a story together. It is meant to be a satisfying and affecting story. That's the outcome that we're primarily interested in. And to the limited extent that we even talk about someone becoming a better player, what we mean is that they're getting better at doing that, at making an engaging and satisfying story along with everyone else. Obviously, these are not the only two paradigms of gaming. A cursory examination of the broader gaming discourse will show that there is a beautiful spectrum. Not even a spectrum. A spectrum has like two ends. This is more open than that. It's a beautiful shit show of different ideas of what gaming is or should be, but that's neither here nor there. My suggestion is that those were like the two dominant paradigms historically in gaming, and Beyond the Supernatural is sort of caught between those two eras. So with that in mind, consider what's presented to the new prospective role player on this page. It is something Palladium likes to do in pretty much every book, which is an extended example of play that doesn't really talk about rules. It just talks about the rhythm of play, the actual conversation that happens at the table. The content of this extended example is different in each game according to that game's setting and premise. So this one begins, like all the others, with the GM describing a scene, and in this case it is horror-flavored. Quote, picture a basement. There is an open step staircase leading down. The walls are covered in white paint that age has turned yellow, large cracks, chips, and blotches revealing the red brick underneath. If you turn to look directly opposite from the stairs, the whole basement lies before you. An automatic washing machine and dryer are along the left wall, with water hoses connecting the washer to the large laundry tub and sink next to it. Directly across from the appliances looms the huge iron belly of an antiquated gas furnace, its large, old-style heating pipes weaving across the ceiling like the arms of a metallic octopus. And it goes on like that, but I'm checking out. Hey, while I'm here, giving you my unasked-for gaming theories and opinions, let me just say, I'm of two minds about box text and the overwrought descriptive style characteristic of box text. I almost never use it. Almost never at my table with me as GM are you going to hear me say that pipes are like the arms of a metallic octopus. That kind of stuff for physical description honestly is not even my favorite in written fiction, but I get other people like it. Other people who experience the world as composed of objects that occupy space and time, I experience the world as a series of connected immaterial concepts that scroll endlessly past my mind's eye while I'm trying to remember that I need to button my shirt today. So obviously that shit's not for me. But even accounting for my personal tastes and limitations, I think in the context of gaming, generally that kind of language is not very effective. The same kind of language that's appropriate to the written word, when spoken, is difficult to follow and retain. And paraphrasing is no help, because if you paraphrase, now you as the GM have this written description of exactly what the room is like, That's not exactly what you deliver to the players, so there are going to be some details potentially missing or misunderstood. They're operating on the basis of what you said, you're operating on the basis of what you read, and what's more, most box text just isn't written very well. So all in all, I'm not a fan of the pipes that are like the arms of a metal octopus. When I do use box text, which I have, in fact, I've written it myself for a few dungeons that I've run in fantasy games, I keep it short and I do read it verbatim slowly so that there's sort of a choose your own adventure feel to the dungeon. I don't paraphrase it or put it into natural language as one would, for example, translate a pre-written speech into one's natural speech patterns to improve comprehension when actually delivering the speech for lots of practical reasons. And also because, in my opinion, if you describe a room in your natural speech patterns, but say that the pipes on the ceiling look like the arms of a mechanical octopus, you just sound like a knob. It reads fine, but when spoken, there is a knob-like quality. Anyway, just a little peeve of mine, although not totally unrelated to my point today, because part of what I want to get across here is that this example of how the role-playing conversation works at the table, while not totally wrong-headed and somewhat useful, is a little bit misleading about how role-playing works when you're someone who's totally unacquainted with it. And part of that is, you're not going to get a lot of GMs talking about blotches in the yellowed white wallpaper revealing the red brick underneath, unless they're reading directly from box text. Anyway, after describing all that, the author continues with a dramatic incident. Quote, "A foul odor is mingled with the musty air. The coal bin door, which is always kept locked, yawns a foot and a half open. Beyond the door is only blackness. Utter blackness. Suddenly, a hoarse, inhuman chuckling begins to rise from below the steps. Like a watching a film," little typo there, "the scene is established, and now our attention is focused to a specific location in the overall scene, the stairs. We have also established an atmosphere and the beginning of action. Got all that? Good. Now let's figure out where you, the player, fit into this." So the GM has described the setting, the GM has then described action, you are now prompted for a response. And that's where we move on to the next subsection on the page, imagine your character. Please note that the text emphasizes the importance of setting a mood with all this setting description. Now the player character is prompted for a response. Quote, "You are not in the basement, but there is somebody whose eyes you see through. That person is your character. An imaginary persona that exists only as stats on a sheet of paper and in your imagination. This is your playing piece in the game. Just like an actor assuming a role for a movie, you play a fictitious character in the game. It is your imaginary character who is standing on those basement stairs. It is your imaginary character who has psychic powers, and who reacts and interacts with the other playing pieces, the other player characters." The page goes on to describe that the role of the GM is to play everyone who isn't a player character, and also to describe the setting, describe the events in the world. There's a little bit of ambiguity here that sort of matches my theory from last time about clashing paradigms. The character is described as your playing piece, but also your role, in the sense that an actor would have a role. I imagine that this is a little bit confusing for a new player, because, like, I'm familiar with Monopoly, let's say, as the prospective new role player. I get that when I play Monopoly, I'm the Scotty Dog. Or the Thimble, but come on. Scotty Dog. Scotty Dog for life. I get that I'm the Scotty Dog, but it's not like I am playing the role of the Scotty Dog. It's not like I'm stumbling upon a railroad and thinking, well, on the one hand, as a Scotty Dog, I'm sort of a homebody. I'd maybe prefer something residential. But on the other hand, there's something scrappy about Scotty Dogs, and there is something of hobo romance about the rails. Like, I mean, I'm not considering the Scotty Dog in the equation, right? Is this a good choice or isn't this a good choice to buy the railroad? So am I supposed to do the game piece thing or am I supposed to do the actor thing? And this page mentions both, but doesn't seem to acknowledge any conflict between them. Anyway, here's the prompt to action. Quote, "The game master says to you, quote, you hear a hoarse, rasping laugh coming from below the very steps you are standing on. You realize that the steps are open. They don't have a back to them. They're like the steps of a ladder, and whatever is below you can grab your ankles. What are you, your character, going to do?" End quote. And then the page continues, offering some options. Quote, "At this point, you must decide what your playing piece, your character, is going to do. Does he slowly bend down to see what's under the stairs? Does he try to run back up the stairs? Or maybe he leaps down the last few steps and tries to run to the tool shed to bar the door and look for a weapon. Or maybe he screams like a girl and calls for help." Okay, so the superficial objection here is to sexism. We all see that. We're all on Twitter here. And I don't mean to dismiss that at all. But there's something else distinctive to gaming going on with this last option. That's what I really want to talk about, and we'll get to it in a minute. But let's just wrap up with the final sort of quote about what the fuck you're supposed to do when you play a role-playing game. according to page 130 of Beyond the Supernatural. Quote, "In a role-playing game, there are no simple answers. There are also almost no limits to what you can do. The only restrictions are that you cannot go beyond the physical, mental, and emotional limits of your character or the parameters of the setting." So limitlessness in this context, I would argue, is not super useful to the new player. This idea that role-playing is limitless, you see floated a lot as a selling point for this form of entertainment, and I totally get it. It's one of the things I love about role-playing. From time to time, I'll try out a video game, but as somebody who plays a lot of role-playing games in an analog format, it just always frustrates me that I lack that choice and I lack that creative ability. The ability to co-write the fiction and act freely in the world just isn't available in a video game in the way that it is in a tabletop game. That's one of the main things I like. I totally understand why you want to sell new players on this. However, new players are also looking for guidance. And a key question that the new player is going to have, and in fact, a key question for the success of the campaign for the players to have answered in the context of Trenchcoat Horror, is if I were to decide I want to scream like a girl, which maybe let's rephrase to avoid the sexism getting in the way. Let's choose a specific girl who screams this way. Mel Bush, the 6th and 7th Doctor companion from classic Doctor Who, a female character devoted to high-quality female screaming. We'll take politics out of the equation. Would it be good play in this scenario where I'm coming down into the basement and I'm on the open-backed stairs and I hear a hoarse laugh underneath? Would it be good play for me to scream like Mel Bush? Assuming there are no, like, dogs in the room I might agitate or delicate glasses I might shatter. This page really doesn't answer that question, and that's the dumbest thing on it. In the context of this comprehensive example, what's lacking is some kind of criteria about what I should do. Not that the game is going to dictate it to me, but are there any expectations? And the reason it's dumb is because almost invariably there are. It would be rare, I think, to have a group where the other players legitimately would be equally fine with you totally ignoring the spookiness of the situation, power gaming your way, like on a purely system basis, into the optimal tactical position to try to like shut down the encounter. Or, on the other hand, to roleplay terror, scream like Mel Bush, and stand there uselessly frozen so the monster eats you. I feel like almost no group is equally cool with both of those options. I mean, most tables would let you do either thing, or pretty near either of those things, but there might be consequences. And oftentimes in these older games, implicitly, those consequences also have a didactic effect. Like, as we saw on last page, you're meant to be becoming a better player. And you're becoming a better player partly through the gentle nudging of the GM, who will delicately nudge you here or gorily kill you there until you start to, like, find the invisible boundaries of how you're supposed to play. I would argue that's not a great way to run your table, but I understand at this time, Palladium is only a little behind the times in not recognizing that there's an issue here. When it comes to Trenchcoat Horror specifically, though, I feel comfortable dinging Palladium for this because this genre and therefore this game are so much about mood. And if players are not considering the mood, if they're not considering the feel of the genre they're supposed to be in their actions, the GM is just going to be fighting a losing battle trying to maintain it. You just can't run Interview with the Vampire with players who are playing like it's Dusk Till Dawn. You can try to enforce the logic of your preferred kind of story on them through mechanics, but that only leads them to game the system more and more, which fights more and more against the mood you're trying to create. There's just no shortcut to having players take some responsibility for making the game feel the way it's supposed to feel, and that's something that maybe a more experienced player could be expected to intuit, or to have already learned during this sort of presumed apprenticeship process by which you learn the hobby from your older sibling or whatever. But on a page explicitly directed at the new player, I think you gotta tip your hand. Like, I think you gotta be straight up with the new player and say, this game is meant to be spooky. It's meant to be Trenchcoat Horror or somewhere on the horror continuum. We might be doing Buffy. We might be doing X-Files. But there's some element of horror here. There's a mood that we're going for. And it's on you when you're making your choice among these limitless options to try to keep that mood intact. That's just a much better way to get where you're going with a Beyond the Supernatural campaign than to put all the burden on the GM to teach the players what genre they're in by kind of hitting them on the nose with a newspaper whenever they try to do something that doesn't match the logic of that genre. Anyway, that's about as up my own ass with RPG theorizing as I care to get on Mega Dumbcast. So that's a wrap for today. Join me next time for the glossary, where players can learn who they are and how they die on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. New episodes drop every day except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big megasode on the top secret Patreon-only RSS feed. If you'd like to get access to that RSS feed and support the show, go to patreon.com/megadumbcast. Contact or check out the show wherever you want. I am Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. MDC, Palladium Books, Beyond the Supernatural, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Zambita. This season's theme song is Horizon Ending by Soft and Furious, whose work you can find at loyaltyfreakmusic.com. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.